Thank you for the bird. Good morning. Before we begin, I have to tell you a little story. Chosen is taking care of Hart. She was in the office holding Hart for just a little bit. And he was fussing just a little bit. And from my office, I could hear her singing, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. And I realized this very advanced meditation instruction. Lojong training. Not even one. Really good. The Dharma is always teaching itself. No matter who's in the teaching self, teaching seat, there is no teacher until there's a student. When there's a student, then the teacher manifests. So she was doing that. I just want to say welcome to those who were not on retreat and welcome back to those who were. And again, if on behalf of George and myself, if I could express our deep gratitude for the continuity of effort and practice across decades. And you are a part of that today, so you will be part of someone's past, which will be someone else's present. So thank you for that. In the sharing circle this morning, I did not take time to give the going home instructions, so I want to offer those to you. My teacher used to share this at the end of our retreats, and he would say, please remember that the people that you're going home to have not been on retreat. And they might say things like, you must be so relaxed. You must feel so blissful. Or they might say, I have a to-do list, and there are 12 things, and if you could get in the truck and go to Home Depot, that would be very helpful. So he used to say, if you live alone, which might feel lonely sometimes, but is also a great luxury, then when you get home, the first thing you should do, even if it's only literally for 1 minute, is go to the place you sit, and in this retreat, do Tonglen. One breath. It's one breath. This is the threading the needle, right, that we talked about on retreat. So go home and take the retreat to your home for continuity. And if you do not live alone, park your car one block away. Sit in the car. One breath of Tonglen. Visualize, you know, that you are in your practice space. One breath of Tonglen. And then when you go home, Don't hesitate in the car. Don't hang out. Those people need to see you. And so bring all of the benefit of your practice, everything you know, breathing in their suffering, breathing out joy, everything you have to give, give that and more, because you know now, you said so in the sharing circle, that the giving away is an endless thing. You don't lose anything when you give. So for those of you in the wider community who are here, and I'm so glad you're here. So good to see you guys once a year. Our practice for the retreat was Tonglen, and included in Tonglen, and almost any practice in our tradition, and I suppose most traditions, is some meditation. And we call our form of meditation shamatha, or calm abiding. And of course, like Zazen, I pretty sure, when we sit down to meditate, we begin to see a stream of experience that is a teacher arising, something to teach us about ourselves. And one of the things that we see is our habit patterns. So it's important to remember that what you see in meditation is probably also manifesting outside of meditation. And so it's a kind of telescope to the rest of your life. And one of the habit patterns that come up that many people talked about in our question and answer interview sessions, or that talk about at the center when I work with people, is the habit pattern of storytelling in the meditation itself. And so I would thought that I could take the few minutes that I have with you today to talk a little bit about storytelling. When stories arise in meditation, the pith instruction, the basic or essential instruction, in our tradition at least, is drop the story and return to the object of meditation. So let's say you have a feeling, and then maybe you're distracted. You discover you're distracted, and then you feel, you begin a story. Oh, I'm not good at meditation. I probably shouldn't meditate. And then it hooks onto another story. In fact, I'm not good at a lot of things, knitting, cooking, you know, just goes like that. It grows, it can take over the meditation. And so we say, the term in English is often translated as severance. Flaming sword of Manjushri, gone, drop the story. Actually, you don't even have to drop a story, you just have to stop holding on to it. And sometimes Lama Michael used to say, just don't pour gasoline on the story, the flame will go out on its own. And it sounds easy enough, but storytelling is enchanting. The Tibetans say, the way that they teach this, or some of them teach it, my teacher taught it, is that when you begin to tell a story, it's a form of enchantment. And the end state of enchantment is trance. Trance. So he was saying, better not to be in a trance. Nothing wrong with trance states, but they are not meditation. So I want to be clear as I give instructions about stories that in no way, because if I don't say this, someone will come and say at lunch. You know? In no way am I saying that you should not tell stories. Please tell stories. Dance your stories, paint your stories, play your stories on the guitar, just not in meditation. Stories are powerful mediums for making a point. And they're powerful because, in part, they're memorable and they're sticky. Sticky. The word for that is shenpa in Tibetan. They hook us. And so because they're memorable and sticky, they are also, they stay around long enough in the mind stream and they beg to be embroidered. And that's why they are enchantments, and that's why they create this trance state, which is really just a form of distraction from the meditation. And that might be easy to let go, except that this is also the habit of story, the habit in this culture of relying on concept, words, instead of felt experience or direct experience. So I listen to my health guru, I don't listen to my body. I listen to my accountant, I don't just look and see, I have no checks. He's empty in there, and not the good kind of empty. Our culture relies on stories heavily for problem solving. And this, in fact, I think, is part of the essence of the problems that we have, because we don't look at the truth right in front of us. We listen to the stories of the culture to make our decisions. So even when we say we have, well, my story, what I'm telling you is evidence-based, the evidence is often biased and rickety, which is maybe polite or not so polite way of saying that it, what it points to, what the evidence points to, is actually not true. It's just a story ornamented with facts. Little something sparkly sewn on at the end. So because we grew up in that culture, and because many of us were students in an education system that valued that and reinforced that habit of storytelling, when we sit down to practice, of course, the habit comes with us. And I think the architecture of that moment in a meditation session, and there are probably many ways to explain this and experience it, but just speaking from my own experience, the architecture of that is I'm meditating in a state of calm abiding or balance or quiescence, sort of equanimity, and then an experience comes in. And maybe the experience, just to use the last example, maybe it's distraction. So it's a very simple experience. It would be very easy to see the experience and come back. No problem. The experience is not the problem. A random thought wafting through the mind stream, that's no problem. It's when we grasp the thought or push the thought away that the problem happens. So when the energy of that experience exceeds, is greater than the energy of your calm abiding, your meditation, so greater than the stability, then it's like an arm wrestling match. It takes over. And what happens is we divert into a habit pattern of some kind. And for many of us, when the energy is the energy of discomfort, or the energy of pleasure. Nothing wrong with discomfort, nothing wrong with pleasure. But when that energy reaches a certain level and it's stronger than our intention, we divert into some kind of habit pattern. We might fall asleep, for example. We might shift our posture a little bit as a way of relieving that tension in that moment. Or we might fall into stories if storytelling is part of our habit. And because we are a very performance-oriented society, many of the stories will have something to do with I can't, I won't, I shouldn't, I don't know, you know, that kind of story about how good we're not in our practice. So what's the problem with that? Let's think about that a little bit. Stories by nature are usually rooted in the past or the future. And so whatever is happening right now, we're missing. And what happens in every right now is the truth. The truth is going by. Impermanence is going by. Magical things are arising. Ordinary things are arising, which is even more magical. And if we look at that truth is the teacher in that moment. But if we divert into story, it's as though the teacher is teaching, but we're on our cell phone texting somebody else. Hey, there's a Dharma event tonight at Heart of Wisdom. We should go. I really long for the teachings. The other problem with stories is that all stories that are based in concept, that is word stories, and that's the kind of story that I'm talking about right now, they're fabrications. And they are also maybe in modern vernacular, we would say they are self-soothing mechanisms, a way to comfort ourselves or to avert disaster of some kind. And the disaster might be very small, like suddenly you don't feel certain. That's a very small disaster. Very small. But it can send you right into a story, some kind of a self-soothing story. The problem with self-soothing stories is they stimulate the brain and the heart in such a way that it feels good. It's kind of petting. And there's nothing wrong with feeling good, and there's nothing wrong with petting yourself. Feel free. But in the middle of meditation, then, that story arises and we have the reward of the self-soothing. And so we want to tell more story. And so then it hooks and it grows and it becomes a complete distraction from the thing we came to do. Then the other problem with self-soothing and stories that match our cultural way of understanding things is that they feel familiar. And sometimes meditation feels not so familiar. Not so familiar. Things happen and they're not our common, ordinary, everyday things. For example, we might feel very powerful in a moment of meditation. And we might collapse right down from that or pull back from that. Like, no, I'm not the powerful one. That's that person over there. And so we go into story. The other thing about words, anything that's based in words, and this happens both on the cushion and off the cushion, and is an obstacle in both cases, I think, is that words are a very thin form of data. They're very thin. So for example, bird. And love. The words don't say it. When my second child was born, they were born and they put her in my hands, and there is no word for that feeling, right? You could talk all day and not even approach the word for that feeling. Or think about chocolate. I made a list of chocolate words. Okay, I used AI to make a list of chocolate words. This is a pretty good word, but it's pretty clear to me that AI has never had chocolate. Rich, creamy, velvety, decadent, bittersweet, smooth, nutty, earthy, that might be true, mellow, dark, sweet, luscious, silky, robust, intense, subtle, fruity, caramelized, buttery, and spicy. That's not a bad list for a machine. And I think with that list of words, if you had those words and I gave you a lemon, you would know the thing was not lemon. Yeah, it's not like it has no information, it's just thin data set. But if I wanted you to know about chocolate, I would give you a piece of chocolate. I would say, you gotta try this. And the minute you put it in your mouth, and you have the direct experience, especially if it's undistracted, of chocolate. Now you know chocolate. With a story, with the words, you know about something, but you don't know the thing. And so in meditation, what we're trying to do is not know about things, but know things. And that's the difference between a story, I think, and direct experience. The Buddha talked about this a little bit. In the sutra, this not my favorite translation of this title, but the discourse on the not-self characteristic. It's a story. A sutra is quite good, you should read it, a couple of pages. It's when we have an experience, he's talking there about many things in the sutra, but to extract it just simply, he was saying, your body is not you. And then there's a whole set of exercises in Tibetan Buddhism that go on forever, and you can discover that I am not this body. That's helpful if you're dying. Your emotions are not you. Your thoughts are not you. You know this, you've heard this Dharma. Your awareness is not you. So what does that look like when we carry that practice? I was talking to a monk not long ago and he did some disastrous thing. Oops. And then he felt shame and guilt and all those things that we all feel. And then he said, I was just walking down the street and I continued and I said, this is not me. Right out of the sutra. I am not this. This is not mine. The shame and the guilt. It just arises. somewhere there's a radio station playing Shame and Guilt, and I was in the range, and things, you know, when the weather's just right, you get the radio station from Astoria over here. It's like that. And so I said, what happened? And he said, I just dropped it because it wasn't my business, out of my lane. Stories cause us to stabilize in a false way because of their familiarity and their self-soothing characteristic. And in meditation, we want to stabilize, but not in that way. We want the true stability of relaxed and intimate presence with whatever's arising. And so it's good to not be addicted to storytelling in meditation. And like any addiction, the only way to deal with it is don't rely on it. Train yourself out of reliance on that. When I think about stories in our culture, I think about the way in my lifetime I have seen stories become architecture and fashion and paintings and songs and buildings. And I've also seen them become education systems and institutions and forms of oppression. And I think that if we relied on direct experience, which we could train ourselves to do in meditation, that we would not be so susceptible to stories which are not true. We would look at a story, even though it was said by a powerful person, and we would say, I'm not so sure about that. Whose story is that, and how did they benefit from me hearing that story? So I think that one of the solutions, this is a bit of a sidebar, but just to say it, that one of the causes of many of the systemic issues that we have in our collective experience is that we are habituated to storytelling. I think it is the root cause of racism and oppression, and I think it's the root cause of a fair to Midland education system. And it might be, I'm still thinking about this one, but I think it might be the root cause of global warming. The idea that we can just use whatever we want on the planet and just use it all up. And the idea that we own anything on the earth is all story. And it would not be so difficult to bear that, except that very close to us are many cultures who have different story. A different story. And we don't listen. We don't listen to their story, because that's another quality of stories. We like to hear our own stories, not so much the stories of others sometimes. So how do we overcome stories in meditation? Again, the pith instruction is, when the story arises in the meditation, the moment you notice the story, of course you can't do anything about it till you notice it, but the moment you notice, which may not be that you hear the words of the story, but you may feel the enchantment in your body somehow. A little slumping forward, a little sparkling of desire or something in the body, right? These might be the precursors to your stories. So it's good to know what happens in your body mind before a story launches. So when you feel the tiny little sparkle, you think, oh man, I'm distracted. And you just let that go and come back. And the story never even comes up. All right, now I'm gonna tell you a story. Because we're not meditating. Just in case it wasn't transparent enough. In meditation, we always want the direct experience, the wordless, timeless truth. And that just means, you know, your parents used to say, maybe, pay attention. It means we offer our attention to that experience, and that experience teaches us. Okay, here's the story. There was once a celestial being. Many Tibetan stories start out that way. Once in a realm called something, there was a being, and this being was a Dakini, which is a female divine being. So The Dakini came down to earth to help the people in a village, and she appeared, since it was kind of a wealthy village, in all of her glory and radiance. So she had beautiful five-colored robes and many bangles and lots of jewels. And she also had a magnificent hat, because we like our spiritual authorities to have big hats in the Tibetan tradition. But she was a very wise teacher, so she gave teachings with this magnificent outfit and the magnificent hat. But she sat in one place like this. And the thing that was magical about the hat was this side was this color, which is one of the two colors that our monastics can wear. And this side was this color. And so then she gave the teaching, and I think Dakinis just beam themselves up into wherever they are, celestial realm. And then the village people were having a feast, as they often do after teachings, and they were saying, oh, this is so wonderful. We got this teaching, that was such a great teacher. How about those five colored silks and the jewels? And I really loved the gold shirt. That was what these people said. And these people said, she was really great. We liked the five colored silks and all of that, and especially that maroon hat. And then one person said, maybe it was you, said, wait a minute. No, it wasn't a maroon hat, it was gold. And this part of the story, I've come to think in the last 20 years, is really important. I'm pretty sure that person said, that hat wasn't that color, that hat was that color. I saw it with my own eyes. Do you get the trickery of that? This is very important. So the next eon or week or day, I don't know, the Dakini appeared again. Oh, did I say the people had a fight? It was political, pretty sure. Democrats, Republicans. And so the Dakini thought, I better go back. So the Dakini went back. And this time, she sat at the other end of the story spelling space. So she faced in the opposite direction. And so this side saw the color they didn't see, and this side saw the color they didn't see. She gave a nice teaching, and she left. How about that Dakini? She was so wise. She was so kind. Yes. I'm so sorry. I said that the hat was yellow, and you said it was maroon, and you were right. It was maroon. I saw it. And both sides did that. And then they said, no, you were right. And the person saying, no, I wasn't right. I was wrong. And then they had a big fight about that. So then the Dakinis are fierce, but always kind. They represent that principle, feminine principle of fierce, mischievous support for your awakening. This time the Dakini came, and she stood and she walked down the center of the hall or field or whatever it was, and she did this. She turned left and right, left and right. Everyone saw both sides. Seeing both sides, they understood more. Understanding more, there was more harmony. More harmony, and the Dakini disappeared. I think that teaching is clear. I think it's an instruction for meditation as well as life. In life, the more you know, the more skillful you can be in the world. In meditation, we want the biggest bite of truth that we can take, which comes not from story, not from words, but from direct contact with our own experience. Thank you.